Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement at the APEC summit in Beijing of a new free trade area of the Asia Pacific that some see as a rival to the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the US is pushing, which involves 12 countries but excludes China and Russia. An expert on the Chinese economy, Barry Norton, the author of The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth, joins us to discuss the possibility that the two treaties are not mutually exclusive and how efforts by China's new leader to reassert Communist Party orthodoxy will likely come at the expense of increased trade and economic growth as President Xi Jinping dials up the anti-Western and nationalistic rhetoric. Then we'll examine the growing ties between Russia and China, whose two leaders, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, are pumping up anti-Western propaganda and stoking nationalistic fever at home while cracking down on democratic aspirations and free expression in the press and on social media and the internet. Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University who specializes in studying the societies of China and Russia, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, "The Sino-Russian Partnership is Stronger Than the West Thinks," and how much the growing anti-Western nationalism in both countries is overcoming traditional suspicions between the two countries, who share a long border with over a billion Chinese on one side and very few Russians on the other side of Russia's vast, underpopulated Pacific region in the east. Then finally, on Veterans Day, we will speak with Philip Butler, a highly decorated combat veteran who spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. He joins us to discuss veterans' issues following Monday's announcement by the new head of the VA that he would like to fire as many as 1,000 employees, and also assess why the U.S. has not won a war since 1945, yet has been involved in hundreds of small wars and is now going back to Iraq for a third war in that divided and devastated country. And joining us now is Professor Barry Norton, who is the Sok Wen Lok Chair in Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego. An authority on the Chinese economy, has recently focused on Chinese trade and technology, in particular the relationship between the development of the electronic industry in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and the growth of trade and investment among these economies. Norton is the author of numerous articles on the Chinese economy and is editor and co-editor of three other books, including The China Circle, Economics and Technology in the PRC, Taiwan and Hong Kong. And his most recent book is The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Norton.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And the Chinese leader at the APEC summit in China has announced the free trade area of the Asia Pacific, the FTAAP, which seems to be quite a prominent rival, if you will, to the current Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that the U.S. is negotiating with 12 other countries, excluding China and Russia. Now, the agreement apparently is to study this new free trade area of the Asia Pacific. Which one of these two has the most legs, do you think?
Well, I think the main thing to recognize is that they're very different creatures. The TPP that the U.S. is pushing is a very, very demanding, they call it a high-quality agreement for the 21st century. And so it really goes far beyond trade, and it's really an agreement to regulate intellectual property regimes, pharmaceuticals registration, information in the cloud, and there's even a code of conduct for state-owned enterprises. So it's really the barrier to participate in this is quite high. Now, that's its greatest strength, and it's also its greatest weakness. It's its greatest strength because there's quite a strong possibility that this agreement, the TPP, will really regulate the relations between advanced countries over the next 20 or 30 years, especially if a similar agreement is signed with Europe, which is under discussion. On the other hand, the Chinese look at that and they, of course, on the one hand, they feel excluded, but also they realize that they're not ready to sign on to those kind of very demanding requirements. They're not ready in terms of their regulatory regime, but even more important, they're just not ready politically. They have said that they want a new round of economic reforms, but they've been very slow in actually pushing them forward. So what she was talking about at the APEC meetings in Beijing was really, on the one hand, he's pursuing a set of negotiations that actually have been underway for a while for a much lower quality, more inclusive, more gradualist trade agreement. But actually, what he talked about at the meeting, the free trade area of Asia Pacific, as you said, this is actually something that's not so much an alternative to TPP as just a kind of general objective that would come down the road. In other words, it would be some kind of eventual merging of these two different negotiating streams. Now, there's no question that it is, in some sense, an alternative to the U.S. approach. But in a way, what was striking about the meeting was that he didn't really stress rejecting the U.S. approach and following the Chinese approach. He did say that a slower, more consensus objective that would bring everybody in would be preferable, but he kind of said any way that gets us there is okay.
So in other words, they're not mutually exclusive, if that's what you're telling us?
Well, they're definitely not mutually exclusive, and it's quite possible that both could take place and that they could eventually end up in a true free trade area that takes in all of the Pacific. But look, that's a long way down the line. And I think the Chinese also look at TPP and they say it has a lot of bad parts as far as we're concerned. It has some good parts as far as we're concerned. But more importantly, it's probably a couple years off and we don't have to make up our minds right now.
So in terms of substance, my understanding is that the U.S. and China have said that they've made a breakthrough in eliminating tariffs on their technology products. Is there anything more, or will that be the takeaway?
Well, first of all, APEC meetings have a long tradition of being essentially feel-good talk meets. And so this one actually in some ways was more substantive because we did see Xi and Abe break the ice between China and Japan. And we also saw some movement immediately after the APEC talks between the U.S. and China on the information technology agreement. And that's important, but it's important not so much because it's a big concrete achievement, although it's certainly something substantial, but because for quite a while, for a year now, the Chinese have been juggling rhetoric of nationalism with rhetoric of economic reform. And it's just been very unclear which one of these strands is going to predominate. With the agreement on electronics and information technology, for the first time we see them making a choice where there's a clear trade-off, and they've made at least a moderate choice for economic reform and openness. So I think that's good news. And we certainly hope that it's the beginning of a series of such choices.
And again, I'm speaking with Professor Barry Norton, who's the Sokwen Lok Chair in Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's an authority on the Chinese economy, and his most recent book is The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. But in terms of it being a photo op festival, the APEC summits, I must say there were some pretty telling photos that came out of it. I don't know whether you saw the picture of our President Xi with the Japanese Prime Minister, but it was the most frozen, awkward, limp handshake I've seen for the longest time.
Absolutely. But I think we have to understand that Xi has to act internationally, but also appeal to his domestic audience. So since he's, in fact, reaching out a hand to Abe, he felt the necessity to combine that with the glummest possible expression to show that he really wasn't enjoying it at all in order to make sure that the home audience didn't interpret this as a concession. Right, so I think that's quite acceptable. It is true that on the Chinese Twitter, there was a photograph going around of that handshake juxtaposed with a picture of Pooh and Eeyore looking extremely glum and dreary. A great joke. But I think the key thing is the handshake and not the expressions.
And the Twitterverse, or whatever it's called, was absolutely a Twitter over Vladimir Putin offering, putting a draping a coat over the Chinese First Lady, and which she took off a few minutes later.
Apparently
the Chinese censors cut that out. So what are the Chinese people hearing from this? Because Putin and Xi apparently are, you know, making amends or getting closer. That seems to be one of the headlines that I've been looking at lately. But, I mean, in many ways, what they have in common is they both of them are pumping up nationalism and xenophobia and anti-Western propaganda.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I don't have any particular insight into the Xi-Putin relationship, but certainly Xi is doing two things that are very troubling to us. One is that is the nationalism, and the other is that there's a clear domestic crackdown on liberal voices and an insistence that people toe the line with symbolic and other shows of loyalty to the Communist Party. And so obviously both of those things trouble us greatly and really undermine the basis for a good relation between China and the U.S. The relations are worse than they have been in a long time. But there is this other strand, which is the possibility that the economic relationship might once again be a positive factor that might create some bridges between the two of us. It hasn't been over the last couple of years, but if the Chinese are serious about pushing forward with the most recent economic reform package, then it might again become a positive element in this otherwise rather toxic stew of incidents between the two countries.
But isn't something surreal, though, Barry Norton, about China and its politics and its economy? Its politics and its economy seem to be in different universes. I mean, you have essentially a capitalist economy growing at warp speed, tremendous amount of Chinese tourism now, a middle class that's going to, you know, soon be larger than the entire population of the United States. And they're traveling around. The children of relatives of the elite are buying property in Australia and Vancouver and here in the United States. I don't get it. I mean, you know, it just seems like the Communist Party is an irrelevant relic that the leadership is determined to try and make relevant, but I'm not sure in the hearts and minds of the people that it has a lot of traction.
Yeah. Well, I share your sense of puzzlement and this disconnect. And of course, as you point out, it goes so deeply. We've seen Chinese society, especially in the cities, just come alive, and people are, you know, it's so much more diverse, and there are so many different points of view, and it's an exciting and interesting place to be. And it doesn't seem possible that the party will be able to reimpose the kind of conformity and that they seem to think that they can do. So I agree. I mean, something has got to give. Now, just to try and understand what somebody like Xi Jinping thinks he's doing, I think part of what he thinks he's doing is taking an organization that had become corrupted and also just paralyzed and bureaucratic and shaking it up and making it dynamic and, you know, making it into an organization that can potentially be a tool to sort of cleanse the cobwebs and cleanse the corruption and make it a more effective and public-spirited instrument. I think that's what he thinks. That's what he believes. I don't think that the approach that he's adopting is really going to work, but I think he has at least imparted a sense of movement and to a certain extent a sense of pride into Chinese society that if he changes tack might be a positive resource, but I think he's got to come up with a new formulation of how this all fits together.
And in terms of the economy, he made a recent statement, President Xi, that was a a bit strange. Morris said, well, you know, it's not going so badly because growth was incredibly high and it's coming down a little bit. How would you rate China's economic trajectory at the moment?
Well, first let me say, I think that comment from him is quite positive and quite right. I mean, China is coming out of this extraordinary period of explosive growth, and it's not going to continue that. And so what Xi was saying is, hey, there is a new normal, and if the economy grows at 7% for the next decade, that's fine. And so that was, I think, an extremely positive comment. That's exactly what we'd like to hear. Now, in addition, the Chinese economy has other problems, and he certainly glossed over them. I don't think the situation is anywhere near as rosy as he stated. But this basic idea that if China can slow down to a sort of 6-7% path, but keep that sustainable, I think that's very right. The problem is they're not going to get there unless they carry through on some of these very dramatic economic reforms, including reforms of the financial system that are not easy and that are often associated with financial turbulence and economic turbulence.
But in terms of China's, I mean, I understand that China is quite bitter, and many other countries are, about what Wall Street did to the global economy in 2008. But there was a piece on 60 Minutes fairly recently of the Chinese real estate bubble that made one think that, you know, they're learning the worst from us.
It's certainly true that the Chinese economy has at least two very serious bubbles. I mean, there's a real estate bubble, and there's there's a sort of a local government finance bubble where there are really literally billions, or I should say literally hundreds of billions of dollars of debt that will eventually have to be written off and either transferred to the central government as national debt or just written off the banks, making the banks take a big hit. So there are definitely, you know, major, major problems that need to be grappled with. But the first step in grappling with them, I think, is for the leadership to recognize that China's passing into this new moderate growth era and that the high growth era is over.
So just in closing then, Barry Norton, back to the announcement of this free trade area of the Asia-Pacific by the APEC summit that they're going to study. And the other one, of course, the TPP, does look like the world ganging up, or at least the Pacific nations ganging up on China. What's your sense of how that's going to be navigated in the future between the fact that many of China's neighbors, the Filipinos and particularly the Vietnamese, and the Japanese are very leery, and on the other hand, I don't think it's particularly useful if you're going to pivot to Asia to gang up on China.
Right. Well, and I don't think, I mean, the Chinese attitude toward TPP used to be completely negative. And they've changed that. They've recognized, you know, that there are positives and negatives, and that, you know, that they can live with a world in which some countries are negotiating TPP. To me, the big choice is China's, and the choice is: are they going to keep making it more difficult for foreigners of all kinds to deal with China and operate in China? Or are they really going to take a step forward and, again, use a further wave of opening as a force to push forward their own domestic economic reforms? And I don't think they've quite made up their minds yet. But if they do proceed with further opening and they package it in a kind of leadership of East Asia against the United States, that's not what I worry about. That's, I think, a perfectly fine outcome that we can deal with through diplomacy and through economic activity. What I worry about is a China that closes itself off, that becomes more nationalistic, and that tries to just incorporate a few, you know, and just incorporate a Hong Kong and a Taiwan into a greater China, and becomes more confrontational with the rest of the world. As long as they're on a charm offensive, I'm not so worried.
Well, Barry Norton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And I also look forward to seeing you here at the UCLA Hammer Forum coming up on Wednesday, November the 19th at 7:30 p.m. We'll have Barry Norton along with other scholars from the 21st Century China program at UCSD, Susan Shirk, and also Tai Ming Chung, who is an analyst on Chinese defense and national security. So we'll be covering all aspects of China's domestic challenges again this coming Wednesday, November the 19th at 7:30 p.m. And again, I've been speaking with Barry Norton, who's the Sok Wanalok Chair in Chinese International Affairs and a scholar with the 21st Century China Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's an authority on the Chinese economy and has recently focused on Chinese trade and technology, in particular the relationship between the development of the electronics industry in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and the growth of trade and investment among these economies. He's the author of numerous articles on the Chinese economy and is editor and co-editor of three other books, including The China Circle, Economics and Technology in the PRC, Taiwan and Hong Kong. And his most recent book is The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the growing relationship between China and Russia, in particular between Putin and President Xi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gilbert Rosman, who's a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. He's the editor of the ASEAN Forum and the author of Northeast Asia's Stunted Regionalism, Bilateral Distrust in the Shadow of Globalization, East Asian National Identities, Common Roots, and Chinese Exceptionalism. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Sino-Russia Partnership is Stronger Than the West Thinks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Rosman.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
And in terms of Nixon's opening to China, which was a tectonic event, after that, of course, the U.S. Was able to essentially be in the catbird seat, playing China off against Russia. Is that situation now likely to reverse? And do you think that China is pretty much in the catbird seat now, able to play off the United States against Russia?
Well, I wouldn't refer to this today as a triangle in the same way it was in the period of the Cold War. Right now, I think there are many other important actors, but I do think that U.S.-Russian relations are the worst pairing of this triangle, and therefore China does have some advantageous position. I don't think it gives it a big advantage, however.
So what is at the root of this, then? The animosity with Russia seems largely to be because of Vladimir Putin. He seems to be obsessed with anti-Americanism, and rather than build up his own country, which the Siloviki, the former intelligence people around him, seem to be looting, the feeling you get is that he's incapable of building up Russia, but he's obsessed with tearing down in the United States. Is this personality-driven?
No, I don't think so. I think that a large part of the elite is really steeped in the thinking of the Soviet era. He's brought in the people with him who have similar kinds of thinking, and the public is overwhelmingly in favor of what he's doing. So I think that he's helped build up a mood of nationalism a sense of humiliation, but I don't think this is personality driven. And I also think that we should not underestimate how much China has encouraged Russia to be wary of the United States and to see the world in terms of a sharp division between the United States and China and Russia.
And Gilbert Rosman, it seems a similar thing is happening in China with Xi Jinping, who is pumping up nationalism and pumping up anti-Western rhetoric in the state-controlled press, cracking down on democratic aspirations and social media, just as they are in Russia. He seems to be reasserting control of the Communist Party, which is, it seems, at odd with their essentially capitalist economy. So how do you differentiate between what Putin's doing in Russia with an economy that basically he and his friends are stealing and what's happening in Russia, where you have in China, where you have this disconnect between the Chinese economy and its political leadership trying to hold on to power via this kind of anachronistic Communist Party?
Well, I think you have both countries where you have parallel situations. And now China is much more integrated into the global economy and has a more long-term strategy. It's not lashing out in the same fashion. I think they're both trying to create an environment where the U.S. is excluded, but it's different in how they're going about it. But I think they both welcome what each other is doing, creating an overlap, a symmetry between what they're doing. So I would say that China sees itself as having long-term advantages, wants to continue building step by step, is not ready for a sharp confrontation right now, and Russia is in much more of a hurry to divide things up. The Russians are using the term a new Cold War. The Chinese are not.
So there was a rumor, Gilbert Rosman, that was floated by some high Chinese officials that in the 2008 financial crash, during the 2008 financial crash, that Wall Street, you know, took the global economy to a near-death experience. Apparently, Vladimir Putin tried to get the Chinese leadership. He tried to collude with them to work together to crash the U.S. economy. Have you followed that rumor and found out?
I've never heard that rumor.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that there was any way to really have that effect on the U.S. economy. Actually, Vladimir Putin was the prime minister then. Dmitry Medvedev was the president.
Right.
And Obama came into office speaking of trying to create a reset to improve relations, and Medvedev responded rather positively. So I don't think that was the case. I mean, there were efforts by Russia, which was much more severely hurt, to draw closer to China as a result of that. And the Chinese were quite outspoken about what the U.S. had done. Their language was very critical of how the U.S. had created this crisis, and they changed their own impression of the balance of power, raising China's status and lowering the U.S. because of this. But I don't think that kind of rumor had much basis, because it would have been extremely damaging to China to get involved in that kind of issue. And Russia was suffering from low oil prices as a result, and not in a very strong position.
Right, and of course now they're suffering from even lower oil prices at the moment.
Right. Well, I'm not sure they're lower. They went down quite a bit for a while at the beginning of the financial crisis. But right, their economy is suffering now.
So, but you can't blame the Russians and the Chinese for being disgusted with Wall Street, can you? And I mean,
well, you have to ask, what is their argument against Washington?
Right.
I mean, everybody can have some grievances. But if you look at the overall argument, then you can say, really, it's very much inherited from the communist era. It's a historical argument that attacks the West and Western civilization in so many ways. It is a geopolitical argument. It's a defense of the Cold War. It's even a defense in both countries of the Korean War. After some years ago, they were saying, well, we're at last acknowledging that North Korea attacked South Korea. Now, if you look at their writings, it's overwhelmingly this was the U.S.'s fault.
And, of course, the same has happened with the textbooks in Russia, that they have reverted back to the Cold War.
In both countries, there's been a crackdown on dissent and on debate where there's a difference of opinion, but much more so recently in Russia. There's a more sophisticated handling of it in China.
So what's your sense, though, of, even though there are signs that the two countries are getting together, and particularly the two leaders are getting together, China and Russia, they still have enormous differences. And there's an awful lot of racism in Russia. And I find it hard to believe that at the end of the day, they can ever really have total trust in this vast juggernaut to their east.
Yes, there's no reason to think there's going to be cultural closeness or even the same kind of trust that existed between countries, let's say, Japan and the United States over the decades. No, that's not in sight. But those issues are really secondary. I mean, that racism is being overcome. Now Chinese tourists are treated more favorably in Russia. There is a public opinion is much more favorable. The old notion of Chinese expansionism and they were going to take over the Russian Far East is still there in the background, but that's so secondary to the main themes they're emphasizing, which are so negative towards the U.S. and the West, or in China's case, towards Japan, that that really doesn't suggest that there's going to be a serious problem in further improving relations. Of course, that doesn't mean total trust, but it does mean that their alignment is not weakening. And those who predict that somehow these national interests in Central Asia or elsewhere are going to sharply interfere with this relationship have been proven wrong repeatedly over the last two decades.
Well, isn't it likely, Gilbert Rosman, that the energy ties will increase between Russia and China? Because as Russia now is escalating militarily by supplying more and more arms to the rebels in Ukraine, and then you've got John McCain and these conservative Republicans coming in that are likely to pressure Obama into arming the Ukrainians. And so relations with Russia and Europe, particularly over their energy ties, are likely to fray further. And China and Russia is making a huge embrace of the Chinese market as an alternative to the European market that they've depended upon for so long. So those things seem to be almost inexorable at this point. And do you think that's going to be the glue that brings the two countries together?
Well, that certainly is a positive thing for their relationship, although the Chinese drive hard bargains, and it's taken them a long time to agree on the two big gas pipelines that were decided on most recently this week, and also on the big oil pipeline that took maybe 10 years before it was finally agreed to. So they have difficult negotiations about that. And also, they're going to take a long time to do this, and the amount of money is extraordinary, and it's not clear that China is going to provide all the money that Russia needs for this, or that Russia can proceed with its labor shortages and other problems in a fashion that will satisfy China, particularly if oil prices and gas prices keep falling. So it looks like that's really helping their relationship, but I don't see Russia being able to turn away from its huge European market anytime soon.
So what is the evidence that you've come up with, Gilbert Rosman, to suggest that the Sino-Russian partnership is stronger than the West thinks? I take it stronger than the Obama administration thinks.
Well, I rely on what I read from the two countries, and I've been doing that ever since the 1970s, reading extensively and what they say about each other. I rely on how they present problems relating to their position in the world, their sense of their own image, and there's such a strong overlap. They both, and recently there's been so much talk of improving relations. Some of the things that were troublesome in their relationship have been treated as if they're handling them well now. I would say Central Asia is one of the biggest problems because Russia has a sense of it. Central Asia is part of the former Soviet Union. These countries really belong in the Russian sphere of influence. China's energy ties and economic ties have been growing very rapidly in those countries. This could be a real barrier. And the leader of China, Xi Jinping, announced a Silk Road economic belt that goes right through Central Asia, and Putin announced a Eurasian Economic Union that relies heavily on Central Asia. And it looked within the last year as if there was some competition and potential for real trouble. But now they've been arguing we really are connecting these two. This is going to be a joint project. And although that's not going to be easy to carry out, the fact that they have been able to present it in this fashion is a sign that there's more overlap. But the biggest overlap really is in challenging what they regard as the ideological threat, the cultural threat from the West and from the West and its allies. Just like the Ukraine situation, China is interpreting overall as one of those so-called color revolutions sponsored by the West to weaken Russia and to create a wider area where Western civilization will spread. Right. Russia's interpreting the Hong Kong demonstrations consistently with China as an effort by the West to contain China and to interfere with China's identity. So I think that kind of overlap suggests this is a very strong relationship.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Gilbert Rosman.
You're very much welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Gilbert Rosman, who's a professor of sociology at Princeton University, where he specializes in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. He's the editor of the ASEAN Forum and is the author of Northeast Asia's Stunted Regionalism, Bilateral Distrust in the Shadows of Globalization, East Asian National Identities, Common Roots and Chinese Exceptionalism. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Sino-Russian Partnership is Stronger Than the West Thinks. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a highly decorated veteran on Veterans Day who spent 8 years in a North Vietnamese prison camp. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on Veterans Day is Philip Butler, a former light attack carrier pilot who in 1965 was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He is a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ian.
And what are your thoughts on this Veterans Day, given that just yesterday the new head of the VA has vowed to completely overhaul the organization, threatening to fire up to 1,000 people, or he doesn't know how to do that, or how it can be done, I should say.
I'm actually optimistic about his leadership, much more than General Shinseki, who obviously didn't have a clue and probably never went out into the hinterland to see what was really going on. But of course, the problem is the legality of everything. Everything goes through Congress, and there are all sorts of laws that that he has to comply with. So nothing's going to happen in a hurry in the huge bureaucracy of the VA. But I do have hope for the first time that there will be some changes made. That notwithstanding, I must say that I'm one of the more fortunate veterans here in Monterey, California. We have a wonderful VA clinic. Our clinic is connected to the regional hospital in Palo Alto. And I have to say that all of us out here in this particular clinic and regional hospital are getting wonderful health care and support. And I have nothing but good to say about my doctors out there. I'm a 100% disabled veteran. And I get just great care here in Monterey, although that's not the case, as we know, all over the country. There are pockets of disaster.
Well, the Obama administration has asked for $125 million to take care of homeless veterans. And in their announcement, they said, you know, all veterans should not be homeless after having served their country, which is obviously a shameful fact that there are homeless veterans. Do you have any idea, though, Phil, of what percentage of veterans are eligible for VA and for government care? Because if you don't get honorably discharged, I believe you can't go to the VA. And I'm wondering what the ratio of dishonorable discharges, because, you know, if you're in the military and you don't get on with your sergeant, you can get, you know, basically some black marks against your name and you may not get an honorable discharge.
I think that's true. I don't know what the ratio is. I know that the vast majority of veterans are honorably discharged, or, you know, and the same for medical discharges. Those veterans, as we call it, have bad paper, as it's known. They can't get VA care. There are avenues for them, I think, some of them, to get things changed so that they can get health care. And I just have to say that I'm not really up on what the statistics are. But with regard to homeless veterans, I think $125 million is pocket change for the federal government. That's nothing. That's just eyewash. And beyond that, I would just my take on the whole thing is, not only should there not be veterans that are homeless, but we shouldn't have single mothers and children and all sorts of people all over our country who are homeless. I think anybody who's homeless and doesn't want to be, because there are a very small number of people out there who choose that as a lifestyle, but the vast majority of people who don't want to be homeless, it's a horrible black mark on our country, as wealthy as our country is, and we can't take care of all of our people with health care and to have enough food and to have a roof over their heads. So for me, veterans, yes, but not just veterans, but people. What really bothers me more than anything is to think of children who are out there who are homeless, and children who are hungry. I know what it is to be hungry. There were times when I was prisoner of war when I weighed close to 100 pounds, and I'm 175 pounds now and a slender guy at 6 feet tall. But I know what it is to be hungry. And it's a horrible thing. You can't think about anything else. But I was 30 years old at the time, and I just can't imagine that happening to little children. It just breaks my heart that we have children, so many hundreds of thousands of them in our country, who are homeless and hungry.
So in terms of your work with Veterans for Peace, how do the Iraq War veterans feel about what looks like a third Iraq War? There's just been a deployment of more U.S. soldiers, or at least an announcement that 1,500 more boots on the ground will be going into Iraq. My understanding, actually, is that it's probably going to be a little more cynical than that, that there'll be a lot of use of contractors and these private contractors.
Ian, this is a gigantic victory for the corporations. And that's about what you'd have to say about it. We're absolutely on a fool's errand to be involved in Iraq. There are so many different tribes and you know, people involved in all of it. It's such a mess. It's a 1,400-year-old mess that Arab boys and girls don't seem able to sort out. And they hate us because we've been propping up the dictators and oligarchs over there for many years who oppress them, and that's why they hate us. And
Phil, they surely can't have no
business being there.
Right, but they surely can't have anything but hatred for us because of what the Bush and Cheney administration did to Iraq. I mean,
they absolutely destroyed the country. The people in Iraq are saying that they were better off with Saddam Hussein, and I wouldn't doubt that they were, even as terrible a human being as he was. But we actually were on Saddam Hussein's side when Iraq was at war against Iran. We were supplying him with the chemicals so that he could make the poison gas to fight the Iranians. I mean, look at our record of what we've done in the past 40 or 50 years over there. It's just horrible. No wonder they hate us.
There's an interesting article, I don't know whether you've read it, Phil, in the New York Times by General Daniel Bulger, and it's basically it's an op-ed. It's called The Truth About the Wars, and what he's pointing out here is, as somebody that served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and he said he lost 80 soldiers, and that basically, you know, we don't win wars anymore. So why do we?
We haven't won a war since, as far as I can recollect, we haven't won a war since 1945.
And is it no longer a requirement? I mean, how do vets feel about it? I thought the whole point was to have a victory parade.
Apparently, I'll tell you, this veteran is certainly sick about it, to think of all the waste in human life and blood and treasure in all of these wars. Since 1945, we've actually been engaged in, some people have calculated, over 100 military interventions all around the world. It's just incredible. And we certainly haven't won anything. Maybe you could say that we briefly won the Gulf War by pounding the Saddam Hussein's troops into submission, but then we lost the war politically. We just haven't figured out since Korea that these wars are political and that you can't win them with guns and people on the ground. And we're just on a fool's errand. And right now in Iraq and Syria, it's just absolutely crazy because we're mixed up in that mess. We don't even know who to support. We don't know who to team up with because everybody's fighting everybody over there, and we're in the middle of their mess, which I think should be ultimately solved by Arab boys and girls and not American ones.
And Phil Butley, you were in North Vietnam. You spent 8 years as a prisoner of war there. And, of course, John McCain is a highly visible ex-POW. You served a lot longer than – you were imprisoned a lot longer than him. He's now chairman of the Senate – well, he will be in the new Senate, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And, frankly, if he had become president instead of Barack Obama – based upon what he said, we'd be in a whole bunch of more wars. As bad as this getting back into Iraq is and Syria, you know, we'd be having a war with Iran as well. What's your sense of what it's likely to be? There'll be more pressure on Obama, won't there, from the hawks in Congress?
I fear that there will be a lot more pressure on Obama. And true to his form for the last 6 years, I don't know how much spine he has to stand up against that kind of pressure, because he seems to cave in and yield and not carry through with what he says he's going to do when he draws red lines and so forth. But I think John McCain is out of his gourd. I've known John for a long, long time, He and I actually were in the same company at the Naval Academy back in 1957 and 58 when he was a first classman and I was a fourth classman there, and John lived right across the hall from me as a midshipman, and I knew him as a naval aviator, and he was a problem as a naval aviator. He managed to wreck a couple of airplanes before he ever went to Vietnam, but his politics are just absolutely insane. I mean, I have no idea that how he could have gone through the same kind of stuff that I went through and come out to be so much in favor of making war all over the world. He certainly should know better, and I don't understand why he doesn't.
And why do you think it is that we've never had a reckoning about any of these wars? The Vietnam War that you served in, and you were, I think, spent longer than just about any other American as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. We didn't have a reckoning after this recent Iraq War, and it looks as if we just can't wait to get out of Afghanistan and forget the whole thing. One of the things that I thought was healthy about the military was that they always have what they call after-action reports, where you assess what really happened and you're supposed to learn from your mistakes. But as a nation, we've never had any after-action reports.
We've never had after-action reports, and we've never tried the war criminals of George Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney. Those guys are war criminals because they tortured and admitted that they tortured combatants, which is against our Constitution and against international law, which we are signed on to. So basically, those three guys are war criminals who should have been tried. They should be in prison now, all three of them, for that. So you're right. There's never been any kind of a reckoning. I just want to say that, you know, I draw a distinct difference between those people who served honorably in our military and the wars we fought. It's always been my saying that I've accepted and told other people is to hate the war but love the warrior. And I certainly have all the respect in the world for all of our warriors who fought in all of these ill-fated wars and military actions all these years. You can't blame the messenger. American warriors are the best. And unfortunately, we get sent in droves and by the thousands to do these stupid errands for the military-industrial complex, and only the big corporations come out to be the winners on this thing.
Well, my understanding is that because of these fool's errands that we've been on, fighting wars in countries we don't know anything about and against people we don't know anything about, it's pretty clear, particularly from Vietnam and from Iraq and Afghanistan, that there's been an awful lot of civilian, what they euphemistically call collateral damage. And my understanding is that a lot of veterans have a hard time living with what they've experienced, not the battles against the enemy, but, you know, the so-called collateral damage that happens. And it doesn't seem like the system is adequate in terms of psychological counseling.
Well, you know, it's hard to get through it. You were raised as an American to have respect for human life and to have a humanistic view of the world, and then you get sent out and you wind up killing innocent people out there. It's awful hard to reconcile that in your mind and in your heart. And so many veterans who've returned home have such a hard time with it that we have high rates of suicide. I've seen figures that say as high as 28 veterans a day are committing suicide. So it's a horrible thing that our government does to young people who are 18 to 30 to send them out into these situations where they're presented with such horrible decisions that they have to make, and they wind up killing, you know, innocent people. I've no doubt that some of the bombs I dropped over Vietnam probably killed innocent people, and it bothers me to this day, 50 years later.
So, Philip Butler, on this Veterans Day, what is your hope for the country? And I guess, for humankind, because, you know, wars have been with us forever, it seems. And this is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One, which was one of the most unbelievable, massive follies of all time. Still to this day, nobody knows. I mean, I was just recently in Australia where I saw a documentary that pointed out that the Australians, who, you know, way away from Europe, they lost more per capita in World War One than any other nation, including the Germans. And then when they came back, devastated and psychologically wounded, the British stuck them with a war bill for going out and throwing their lives away for the British Empire. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that, you know, the war to end all wars hasn't ended any war.
That's right. This is the 11th month and the 11th hour of that day, and it's really, honestly and truthfully, this is not Veterans Day. This is Remembrance Day. Remembrance Day of the horror of World War One, which was supposed to be the war to end all wars. We were never supposed to get into wars again after that, but unfortunately, politicians have managed to keep the war making and the suffering and the dying and everything going since then. But I don't know to have the exact date or president, but somewhere back in the 1960s or 50s or 60s, it was politicians decided to change it from Remembrance Day to Veterans Day. And I think basically politicians have a tendency to use veterans as pawns for their own gain and their own ends, to make themselves look good and to try and put a happy face or a good face on all the wars that our veterans have gotten into. But people wish me a happy Veterans Day, and I very much appreciate that, and they thank me for my service, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, I'm fully aware that people in this country are actually divorced from what it really is to be in the military. We have such a small number of people now that we send out to fight our wars for us, but basically this really is and should be and should be remembered as Remembrance Day, and hopefully in doing so we can stop getting into these wars. The American people can get control of our government again and take the control away from the corporations and the wealthy elite.
Well, Philip Butler, I thank you so much for joining us on this Veterans Day.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Philip Butler, a former light attack carrier pilot who in 1965 was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He is a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.